Hello and welcome to Story Junkies, where we talk movies, books, and television because we're addicted to story. I'm your host, author Pete Bauer, and here with me is Baby Falcon.
And yes, people really do call me that.
You know what we should do? We should come up with, you know, remember on Psych where every time Gus was introduced, he had a different name?
Yeah.
So we should come up with a different backstory for why you're called Baby Falcon.
For why I'm called Baby Falcon?
Yeah, like maybe this time you were raised by falcons in the wild.
I was.
Oh, is that the true story?
That's the true story.
Dang it.
We can't start with the true story.
No, all right.
Got to build up to
all right.
it.
Well, maybe you were a spy and your code name was Baby Falcon.
Well, you'll never know.
You'd have to kill me.
I would.
So today we are talking about a classic movie. It's a double classic.
It's a double classic.
Yeah, it's so classic, it's uber classic.
I would even throw in another classic.
Make it's
it a triple classic. Like the triple crown?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Or triple burger.
What?
Like, you know, three patties on one burger.
No, it's far better than that.
I don't know. I really like hamburgers. It's a triple burger of films.
Except it's one film.
Except it's one film.
And if you have absolutely no idea of what movie we're talking about, well, I mean, just shame on you, frankly.
Right. I mean, obviously.
It's obviously.
If it's a triple burger of movies, it's Casablanca.
Triple Crown.
Or Triple Crown.
There we go.
If you want to go there. Casablanca is a romantic drama released in 1942 during World War II and is based on an unproduced stage play called Everybody Comes to Rick's. The film, directed by Michael Curtiz, stars Humphrey Bogart as Rick, Ingrid Bergman as Ilsa, and Paul Henreid as Victor. Also featured are Claude Rains as Louis Renault, Conrad Veidt, I believe his name, is Heinrich Strasser, Sidney Greenstreet as Signor Ferrari, and Peter Lorre as Ugarte, or Ugarte.
It's one or the other.
Right. Wait, they don't really call him by his name. You know what I mean?
I don't even know which character you're talking about, and I watched this movie the other day.
Peter Lorre is the guy with the big eyes in the beginning.
Oh, that guy!
So the film focuses on Rick, an American expatriate who must choose between his love for Ilsa and helping her and her husband, Victor Laszlo, escape the French-controlled city of Casablanca so Victor could continue his fight against the Germans. The masterful script was written by two brothers, Julius and Philip Epstein. Or Epstein. We have a lot of names in here that could go either way. As well as Howard Koch, or Koch, who, by the way, wrote the radio drama War of the Worlds, performed by Orson Welles on radio in 1938.
And that's a story we should tell you next time.
Yeah, that's pretty epic. The film was shot entirely at Warner Brothers Studio in Burbank, California, with the exception of one sequence, which was shot at the Van Nuys Airport. Although Casablanca was an A-list film with established stars and first-rate writers, no one involved in its production expected it to be anything other than one of the hundreds of ordinary pictures produced by Hollywood that year. However, Casablanca went on to win a number of Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay. Its reputation gradually improved to the point that its lead characters, memorable lines, and its pervasive theme song have all become iconic, and the movie consistently ranks near the top of the list of the greatest films in history.
And do you concur?
Yeah, it's surprisingly timeless, even though it's made in the 40s.
And there's a lot of reasons, I think, for that. As I was preparing for today's episode, thinking about the movie, doing research, that we can dive into once we get into the nitty-gritty of the plot. But there really is a timeless element to this picture. And that's so impressive because so many filmmakers put all of their effort into creating a picture that will stand the test of time. And this one, which they just thought they were going to make and release like a bunch of other movies, has stood out from the crowd, and not only stood out from the crowd in the time that it was made, but has persisted to stand out from the crowd throughout history.
I think generally, for good and bad, there's aspects of that film that are timeless in the sense of human nature and the good and bad side of human nature and how we treat each other. I think that is one of the timeless aspects that make it always relevant.
Plus, it's got so many incredible lines.
I know.
It's one of the most quotable films I've ever seen.
It is. When I wrote that it's a masterful script, I mean that. It is brilliant. And not only that, but the actors actually say them so perfectly. It just resonates really well.
Well, knowing that it was adapted from a play that was never produced actually made a lot of sense to me in relation to how all of these lines are so brilliant and so masterfully played by the actors, because when you're in a play, plays are so dialogue driven because you don't have room or space or ability for these big masterful cinematic sequences. All you have is a stage, some sets, and some actors, and you have to tell a compelling story, and that most often happens through the dialogue. And so I kind of see the vestiges of that in Casablanca, even though it's a film, having that it's almost written like it's a play.
Yeah, you can see that in the sense that almost the entire movie takes place at Rick's Americana Cafe, which is a nightclub. So it's a single location like it would be in a play as well. Okay, so let's break down the story, shall we?
Let's do it.
And the characters, since you're the character person and I'm the plot person.
And we can not exceed our roles.
That's right. Step off. Okay. Okay. So let's go into Act One. The story opens in, guess where? Casablanca.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Shocking. Huh. Yeah. Located in a French-controlled part of North Africa. The inciting incident, which is the event that kicks off the whole story, is really interesting because it actually happens off-screen before the movie starts and is revealed to us through text at the opening of the movie, which is a really bold choice.
Very uncinematic choice, actually.
Right. It's the weakest thing of the whole movie, actually. In it, we find out that Nazi couriers have been killed, and letters of transit, which will allow anyone to travel anywhere without restraint, have been stolen. In a place like Casablanca, which becomes a way station for refugees escaping the war, such letters are invaluable. To exemplify the letter's value, the film opens showing a man who is part of the French resistance being shot in Casablanca for not having his papers. We are then quickly and expertly shown the type of people who are stuck in this small town. We see a charming pickpocket steal from an unsuspecting couple. A line of desperate people staring at an incoming plane, their faces expressing their longing to be the next one to get on a plane and go to America. And finally, we're introduced to a young married couple who can't afford to leave, either through legal or illegal means. On that arriving plane, Nazis exit, including Heinrich Strasser. He's a German major. They are met by the local authority in charge, Louis Renault. Together, they go to Rick's, a restaurant and club that is also home to a secret casino. It is the main place of activity in Casablanca, offering entertainment, and is full of people manufacturing schemes to escape this desert town, such as by selling jewelry or booking illegal passage on a boat for cash.
What was the play called that the movie was based on?
Everybody Comes to Rick's.
I'm pretty sure they say that in the movie. There's a scene where the Gestapo is asking where someone's going to be, and Louis goes, oh, he'll be at Rick's. Everybody Comes to Rick's.
Yeah, yeah. When we are introduced to Rick, we see him denying entry to the casino to a Frenchman who works for the Deutsche Bank. Then, a slimy black market trader named Ugarte approaches Rick. The sad man wants Rick to be impressed by him and reveals he is the one who killed the Nazi couriers and stole the letters of transit. For the first time, Rick is impressed. Ugarte asks Rick to hold on to the letters until the heat dies down, and Rick agrees. Next, Signor Ferrari enters the club. He owns a rival establishment called the Blue Parrot. He also sells people on the black market. He offers to buy Rick's club from him, but Rick says no. During the conversation, we find out that even though there is a world war going on, Rick lives in the moment and doesn't take sides. Renault then meets with Rick and tells him that a French freedom fighter named Victor Laszlo is in Casablanca and will more than likely come to his club. He warns Rick to stay out of whatever unfolds. Renault is worried that Rick's history of favoring the underdog will end up helping Laszlo. Rick's answer? I stick my neck out for nobody. The Germans arrive at the club and Renault arrests Ugarte for killing the couriers. Before his arrest, he pleads for help from Rick, but Rick doesn't move. The police don't find the letters of transit on Ugarte, but arrest him and take him away. When Rick is asked by the Germans about his allegiances, he tells them he's neutral on everything. Then, as Rick steps away, Victor Laszlo and his wife Ilsa walk into the club. Everything in Rick's life is about to change. And that's the end of Act One. So, the most amazing thing to me in this first act is that they seamlessly introduce all these people.
The thing that impresses me so much from a directorial standpoint about this opening act is that the director was able to highlight who the important characters are while at the same time filling the frame full of people and refugees. There are so many moments on camera where there's a bunch of people present, and I remember noticing as I was watching the film that even though there were 10 people on camera and on screen, that I still could tell and point out which were the ones I should be paying attention to.
And the director does a great job of, in that background, having secondary characters that come into play, and also secondary actors that work at Rick's, which are hilarious. And I didn't go into that in this description because it wasn't necessary to the plot. It's one of the best examples of relaying an immense amount of information in the first act in a way that just flows so effortlessly that you don't even notice it. You're just absorbing all these people because all their stories are really unique. The situation is unique, so you're kind of getting a feel for the landscape and the world they live in. And there's humor in it. There's con men and things like that. And there's desperate people. And it's just this odd eclectic mix. There's music playing, there's a piano player, it's a nightclub, which in this really sad town, it's such a weird mix of both character and atmosphere and scenery that you just kind of watch it going, where am I? And you kind of want to be there. At the same time, you don't want to be there for the reasons that those people are there. You know what I mean? It's a really fascinating way of introducing a location and people.
One of the most interesting parts about this film to me is the balance between realism and theatricality.
Yeah.
Because it's a very theatrical movie. The sets are obviously sets. The dialogue isn't always 100% realistic, but you buy into it in the moment. And because there's this artificiality to it that comes with a theatrical type performance, you're able to distance yourself from any disbelief in what you're watching, for which more realistic films don't have that luxury because they're portraying something that has to be real every step of the way. But because you have this theatricality in Casablanca, when there are these really funny lines, or there are these obvious set pieces, when there are moments where it looks like a literal spotlight is shining on the characters, you buy into that because you know it's telling a story. But at the same time, there's a realism to everything that's going on screen, because actually a lot of the extras were refugees from Europe in the war when this was filmed. One of the actors, the actor who played the Gestapo,
Conrad Veidt.
Yeah, so he was actually a silent film star in Germany. He was born in Berlin.
Wow.
And he escaped Germany because his wife was Jewish in the middle of the war. So there's so many different stories like that of the people who are actually on screen. So it's this really unique balance between realism and theatricality and portrayal of a story versus sending a message, which is what the film was trying to do. It's really fascinating.
It's almost like a transition from the stilted acting and production style of 40s and 30s movies like we talk about with Hitchcock. It's like, you know, they meet and 2 minutes later they're in love because he needs them in love to put them in peril. And you just kind of buy it in those movies.
On a train track.
There's always a train track. They're always going to die with a woman attached to the train track. And this one has this weird sort of combination because in the 50s with Marlon Brando is where that neorealism, that were just grounded much more in the everyday reality. This movie seems to like hover in both of those worlds where you have this 40s style acting and 40s style writing. Yet at the same time, the subject matters they're talking about are very disturbing when you're talking about, a club owner, that Ferrari character who openly says, yeah, well, I trade in people. You know, it's a profitable thing in a place like Casablanca. Rick doesn't care about who lives or dies. During a world war, you know, you have these refugees who are selling their family heirlooms just so they can try to get enough cash so they can get an illegal transport somewhere. I mean, these are real tangible issues that don't feel as deep because of the 40s style, but they also don't disrespect the gravity of those situations either within that 40s style. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so timeless, is because it allows you to watch it in an entertaining and slightly distant way while still paying respect to the real gravity of the situations that those type of characters then and now would be in. Because we have places in the world that are dealing with these same issues today.
And I think a large part of that is because both the director and the screenwriters were masterful in giving due diligence to each moment and to each character. So I remember when I was researching for this podcast episode, hearing a film critic say that if you actually pay attention in the film, all of the minor characters in Rick's Cafe have a scene where they are featured. Every character has one memorable scene.
Yeah, and the actors are so good. There's a phrase in acting which is there's no small part, just small actors. In other words, some of the most memorable people that resonate with us in movies are the smaller characters that are just really, really funny.
That's even happened in films that came out in the past 10 years. I remember there was a receptionist in a movie. She had two lines and she delivered them so well in a way that was subtly funny, but not out of character. And I still remember her.
Right. So they had the right actors taking these moments, these little moments for their characters, and they are so great. You understand who they are. You understand the type of person they are, what they value. You understand all of this. Not only that is because of the way it's written, but more because the actors took that moment that they had, that it elevates these little side moments.
And all of those characters become real people to you because of that one scene, even though they don't get another scene later on.
It's the tapestry that creates the entire world. Again, it's a realism to this world because even the side characters, even if they're funny or tragic or whatever, are completely believable in this world. So not only are these characters living in this tragic existence, but even the minor characters, whether they're funny or not, fit within that tragic existence as well. So you feel like the world is much bigger than just Rick's, and that this World War II experience is much greater than just this movie.
I heard a film critic describe Casablanca as the merging of entertainment and art without being pretentious.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It is the perfect descriptor for the film.
Absolutely. All right, let's go on to Act Two, shall we? Okay, in Act Two, Laszlo and Ilsa sit at a table near the piano player named Sam. She recognizes him. A man named Berger, who is a member of the French underground, sits at their table and feigns trying to sell Laszlo a ring for cash. Instead, they talk about the status of the local underground movement and trying to get Laszlo to America. Renaud then joins them at the table, and Berger leaves. Renaud asks Laszlo and Ilsa to join him in his office the next day to discuss his reasons for being in Casablanca. While Renaud talks to them, Ilsa asks about Sam and Rick. Her history with them is greater than she is letting on. Major Strasser then talks with Laszlo, giving him veiled threats and ultimatums, but Laszlo will not be deterred from continuing his work against the Germans. Laszlo knows that even though they are in a French-occupied land, the Germans will have influence over the corrupt police like its commander, Louis Renault. When Renault and Strasser leave them, Berger returns and tells them they were supposed to meet with Ugarte and get the letters of transit, but he was arrested and later killed, and the letters are missing. Laszlo and Ilsa are stuck in Casablanca. Ilsa leans over and asks Sam to play a song as time goes by. At first, Sam refuses, but eventually gives in. Rick returns to the club, angered that Sam is playing that song, but then he sees Ilsa with Laszlo. Rick congratulates Laszlo on his work, and Rick and Ilsa share looks, but they don't say much more to each other. Victor and Ilsa then leave the club. Later that night, the bar is closed. Rick sits in the dark, drinking alone. Sam tries to console him and convince him to go to bed. Rick complains. They're asleep in New York. They're asleep all over America, which is obviously an indication of America being asleep during the World War. And during the conversation, we hear one of the memorable lines of this movie. Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine. Rick asks Sam to play as time goes by. As he does, we enter a flashback to Ilsa and Rick in Paris, days before the Nazis entered the town. They had fallen deeply in love. Rick has been working for freedom fighters. Ilsa has a sadness about her. In this scene, with the clink of glasses, he tells her, "Here's looking at you, kid." As the Nazis approach, explosions are heard in the distance, and Ilsa asks, "Is that cannon fire or my heart pounding?" They agree to leave the city together and run from the Nazis. They would gather their things and meet at the train station and take the last train out. Rick arrives at the train station during a pouring rain, but Ilsa doesn't come. She gave a note to Sam to give to Rick. Rick reads the letter, the raindrops streaking the ink like teardrops, as Ilsa tells him that she can't go with him. Back at Rick's, Ilsa enters the closed bar, and she and Rick have a contentious fight. He's never stopped loving her, and in his drunken stupor tries to make her hurt the way he hurts. Ilsa asks for his help. He refuses, and she leaves. And that's the end of the first day in this story. That's a busy day.
It's a very busy day. I'd probably need a drink after that day, too.
Now, the next day, Laszlo and Ilsa arrive at Renaud's office. On their way in, they pass the young couple trying to leave the country, but that have no options. In the office, Renaud and later Strasser challenge Laszlo on his intentions. Laszlo finds out that Berger, the French underground contact, has been killed. His death shows Renaud will not defend Laszlo, but bow to the will of the Germans. Laszlo and Ilsa leave the office. Outside the office, Renaud secretly offers to give the young married woman a visa for her and her husband if she sleeps with him. Meanwhile, Rick goes to the Blue Parrot, where Ferrari offers to buy from him the letters of transit. Rick says no. On his way out, Rick spots Ilsa in the local market and offers to see her that night at his club. She tells Rick that Laszlo is her husband. Inside the Blue Parrot, Laszlo meets with Ferrari. He tries to secure safe passage. Ferrari tells him he can't help. He says, "It would take a miracle to get you out, and the Germans have outlawed miracles." But he does tell him that Rick has the letters of transit. Back at Rick's, the Germans arrive and tell Renaud that Laszlo is too dangerous to remain alive. At a table nearby, the head waiter Carl has drinks with an older couple, celebrating their ability to fly to America. It was a good point in the story to let people know some people get out, and so there are ways to leave this place, but it's rare. Rick is near the bar. The young married woman approaches him and asks for help. He tells her she's too young to be in a club like this. She asks if her husband, who was in the casino trying to win enough money to buy their way out, would forgive her if she did a bad thing, which she's referring to sleeping with Renaud. And she also wanted to know if Renaud would keep his word and give them safe passage. As Laszlo and Ilsa arrive, Rick goes into the casino and lets the young husband win enough money to get out. The young woman thanks Rick. Renaud is upset that Rick let the woman win. Now she doesn't have to sleep with him. And then Renaud called him a rank sentimentalist. Laszlo meets with Rick and offers to pay for the letters of transit. Rick says no. Laszlo asks why not. Rick tells him to ask his wife. And that's the end of Act 2.
Dun, dun, dun. Drama, drama, drama.
So the stakes start to raise here in the second act, right? Everyone's been introduced. You get the true history behind the shared looks. And Ilsa's asking about Sam and Rick. You get that history. And I remember the first time I saw this movie. And when you see Rick, when he does the flashback, he and Ilsa are driving. And he's smiling. And I was thinking, I don't think I've ever seen Humphrey Bogart smile. You know, because he's always playing like the hard-boiled detective or something like that. It really took me aback. Like, oh my gosh, that's what he looks like, smiling. And I read about how Humphrey Bogart hated love scenes. Hated them because he knew he would look horrible doing them. And he was so embarrassed by them. He's like, I hate these. Let's make them as short as possible. So that's why you never see him do them unless they're clever dialogue-based in any of his movies. Anyway, so in the second act here, all the stakes are raised and you can kind of see where the allegiances are defined. And, you know, Laszlo and Ilsa are in greater threat and danger. Rick is pulling away from everybody, especially the woman he still loves, which puts them in greater peril.
Well, he actually smiles for a brief second when Ilsa walks in through the door when he's spending the night drinking. I don't know if you noticed that, but he smiles for a brief second and then the somber, bitter frustration takes over and the drunken stupor makes itself known.
Which is great because it's kind of like he loves her and he's like, oh, there she is. And then like, oh,
there she is. Well, it's actually interesting because if you look back on how they introduce Rick to us, the audience, there are two things that happen. One, you see him say, okay, Rick, like he's signing off on someone's paycheck. But literally the first thing you see is Rick is okay. And then it cuts to him playing chess, which is a very strategic game, but by himself.
Interesting.
So it's an interesting way to introduce his character. So much about the character's internal motives and internal world, all that subtext is told through lighting in this film because it's kind of a noirish type film.
Yeah.
But there are other elements that come on screen that reveal more about what's going on with the characters. And so I think it's interesting in that moment that he's introduced that Rick's okay and he's playing chess by himself. And then Ilsa comes in and he's immediately drunk.
You know, one of the things that makes this movie so timeless is the love story, right? Most people have been in a relationship that didn't go well, where one person left and the other person was still in love or had feelings for them. So there's that, right? When Rick is feeling that, or you see that they wanted to be together and they didn't, there's a natural tug at that, right? It's like, oh, you know, that's too bad. So I think that's one of the reasons that this story resonates all these years later, is because it's almost Shakespearean love story, which is timeless. And it's not hampered by an overt older style of acting that betrays its like reality and humanity. So you still watch it and you still feel it because it's not so stuck in the 40s style acting that it seems unreal.
Yeah, it's really interesting for me to watch these classic films and see how Casablanca has resonated with so many people, not only because of this grand love story that people remember, but also because they can in some way picture themselves in Rick's cafe in Casablanca versus something like Citizen Kane, which is another classic film, brilliantly filmed, but just doesn't have that same level of what? Resonance, something you can identify with.
It's hard in Citizen Kane for me to connect with a massively rich, miserable man.
He's not very nice either.
Yeah.
Rick, I mean, at least is occasionally nice.
Well, here's the thing that I love, which we'll talk about a little bit later, but they hint the entire time that Rick hates the Germans. The entire time. So when he and Ilsa are in love in Paris before the Nazis come in, he's a freedom fighter against the Nazis, and they're going to go on the run, and they're not like running away to America to safety. They're running away to continue the fight against the Germans. So the first time we meet him, he's denying a French banker because he works for Deutsche Bank. He works for the German bank. And there's all, and then none of these are like spotlighted or highlighted, but there's every time Rick interacts with someone that's tied to Germany, he has a negative experience with it. It's one of the things that makes it so well written, because it's layering in. Rick says all these things that he doesn't care and he he's neutral, but his actions, even subtly, even though he's generally neutral and generally doesn't care, deep down, he really, really hates the Germans and the Nazis.
It's almost like he can't help himself, because right? There are two ways that Rick acts in Casablanca. One is actively and one is permissively. So there are times that he will either not permit or permit something because it's anti-German, versus the times that he actually acts himself, which is a different situation.
Right, and he has all the authority because he's in the most important club in this tragic town where all the business, both legal and illegal, happens. So what he says goes, outside of like legal authority, whether that's the French police or the Nazis. And that perfectly leads us into Act 3, because Act 3 opens where, in the club, drunk German soldiers begin singing a German song. In response, Laszlo stands at the front of the club and begins singing a French song.
He was very offended that the Germans, that the way that what Paul Henry chose to portray that moment, he was like, I am singing the French anthem.
Well, we have to remember, too, this is a French-controlled territory. Granted, they're refugees from all over the world, but most of the people here are French or have ties to France.
Well, and the Germans, they don't have authority there. So I think that he was just furious.
Right. So other French citizens in the club and other anti-Germans join in. And then Rick, again, here's one of those moments. Rick nods and allows his musical band to join Laszlo. And they drown out the Germans.
Well, because Laszlo goes to the band and says, play this song. And they all look at Rick.
Yeah.
And Rick goes, you can play it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Heinrich becomes upset. Huh. At the behest of Renault, he shuts down the club, who, as people flee, Renault receives a portion of Rick's casino winnings from a dealer because he's a corrupt official. And one of the interesting things about this is Renault, in the very beginning, explains that he's just a poor, corrupt police official. And the entire movie is layered with his corruption. Like, almost every scene, and this is really great writing, almost every scene has a reference or an act where he is being corrupted or is corruptible. It's really interesting because he is very charming as an actor, so you love him, but you can't trust him at all.
Well, and that line is also just so great. Rick comes over to ask him why he's shutting down the club, and he goes, I am shocked, shocked to learn that there is gambling happening in this establishment. Then the dealer comes over and says, your winnings. Ah, thank you. And then he walks away.
It's great. It's so great. Heinrich tells Ilsa and Laszlo that Laszlo must go back with the Germans to occupied France, or that he'll be killed. Laszlo refuses, and he and Ilsa go back to their apartment. There, Laszlo asks if she and Rick had a love affair while he was in a concentration camp. She denies it. He trusts her, which for me, was an interesting juxtaposition to the young woman who was worried about her husband, whether he would believe her when she lied to him. And in this case, Laszlo does believe her when she lies to him.
See, I disagree. I don't think he does believe her. I think he knows that she had a love affair with Rick, but it's like a gift to her that he's letting her think that he doesn't know anything.
Okay, let me rephrase. I think you're right. He accepts it.
Yes, he's not going to press it.
Yes.
Because, you know, to be fair, she didn't know that he was alive. You know, I think he doesn't really hold that over her.
Right.
Plus, he loves her a lot.
Right. So after that, Laszlo goes to a French underground meeting, and Ilsa leaves and sneaks into Rick's, which of course is now closed. When she shows up, she asks Rick for help. He replies, "As long as I have those letters of transit, I'll never be lonely," because people keep coming up to him and asking and asking and asking. She pleads to help Laszlo's cause. Rick replies, "I'm the only cause I'm interested in." Ilsa pulls a gun. He responds with, "Go ahead and shoot. You'll be doing me a favor." He confronts Ilsa about her leaving him at the train station. She tells him that she was told her husband died in a concentration camp and was going to go with him. But that morning, when she was ready to leave, she found out that Laszlo was alive and had arrived in town. He was very sick, and she agreed to stay with him and let Rick go. She tells him she'd never have the strength to leave Rick twice. Laszlo and Carl return to the club from the underground meeting and hide there while the German patrols are on the lookout. Rick has Carl secretly take Ilsa home, who is hiding from Laszlo in Rick's office. Rick and Laszlo talk. Laszlo tells him that each man has a destiny for good or evil. He knows Ilsa is in love with Rick, and he asks Rick to use the letters of transit to escape with Ilsa. Laszlo would stay behind. After that conversation, Laszlo is arrested. And that is the end of Act 3.
Wow. I just wanted to make that noise.
That was deep. I mean, I think you really captured it.
How else do you respond to such a conversation? I was in a concentration camp, and I know my wife fell in love with you, but I just love her so much that I want her to be safe, so you can run off with my wife and I'll stay here and then get immediately arrested. Wow.
Yeah, if there's any other time to use that, it's that moment. Although I don't remember hearing you say that when we watched the movie, so you must have just felt it inside.
I like a falcon.
Here we go. Like a baby falcon.
Like a baby falcon. I keep most things inside, which is not at all what baby falcons do.
But do we really know what baby... Well, we do know what baby falcons think.
I don't know that you do, but I do.
You're like a superhero, like Aquaman for falcons.
Oh, that's just an insult.
Hey.
Who wants to be Aquaman?
But he can talk to fish. You can talk to falcons.
I can't talk to falcons. I am a falcon.
Okay. My bad. Sorry. I didn't know I crossed some sort of line there. All right, well, let's move back to Casablanca.
All right.
So in this act, again, they're dialing up the tension, right? The consequences are getting higher. The danger's getting higher. The risks are getting higher. And what's interesting is the love triangle is becoming more openly exposed, right? What was originally hidden, but hinted at in the first act, and then explained in past tense in the second act, is now present and more forceful in the third act.
It's a really interesting juxtaposition, like many things in this film are, because it's open, everybody's aware of it, but it's also not discussed.
Yeah, well, back then there was decorum. You know, you didn't talk about things. People's private lives were private, and some things would never be discussed openly, right? Like if you think your wife was having an affair, you would never discuss that with anyone else. So there was private lives were very, very private, and especially with characters that, and I've always found these interesting, even when you look at like British historical dramas, there's a propriety to the status of who these people are, like how they acted. If they elevated themselves above that sort of base conversation, they recognized it and acknowledged it, but they didn't dwell on it. They were above all of that. And so there's a certain class and a respect that Rick and Laszlo have from different perspectives that they have this conversation, but it's done in a very respectful way. So the next day, Rick is in Renault's office, inquiring why Laszlo has been arrested. Renault blames the Germans, but Rick tells him the charges won't stick. He tells Renaud that he has the letters of transit and that he's leaving on the last plane that night with Ilsa. He offers to have Laszlo arrested that evening while Rick acts as if he's going to give him the letters of transit. That would make the arrest stick. Then Rick would use those letters of transit to leave with Ilsa. Renaud agrees to meet him at the club, where he can witness the transaction, and then arrests Laszlo. Rick goes to the Blue Parrot and sells Rick's to Ferrari, making sure that Sam could continue to work and get a percentage of all the profits. Ferrari agrees. That night, Renaud arrives at Rick's, which is still closed, and he hides. Ilsa arrives first, then Laszlo. Rick gives the letters of transit to Laszlo. Renaud steps out and arrests him, as planned, but Rick stops Renaud, holding him at gunpoint. He tells Renaud to call the airport to give them access to leave. Renaud acts like he's calling the airport, but he doesn't. He actually calls Major Strasser and, as if speaking to the airport staff, tells Strasser to meet him there. At the airport, Rick, Renaud, Laszlo, and Ilsa arrive. Rick has Renaud write the names of Laszlo and Ilsa on the letters of transit. Ilsa is confused. Rick gives Ilsa to Laszlo and convinces him that Ilsa acted like she loved him, and he acted like he believed her. He then gives the papers to Laszlo. Laszlo gets on the plane, but Ilsa doesn't want to leave Rick. He tells her, "Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilsa, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that." And then he finishes with, "Here's looking at you, kid." As Ilsa gets on the plane, Renaud warns Rick that he'll be arrested once the plane leaves. Strasser arrives and pulls a gun on Rick. Shots are fired, and Rick kills Strasser. Other police officers arrive, and Renaud covers for Rick as the plane leaves, telling his officers to round up the usual suspects. As the plane flies away, Renaud and Rick walk down the runway. Rick says, "Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship." And that is the end of Casablanca.
What a film.
It is great. So what I really liked about the way they set up this final act is Rick, who is selfish and heartbroken, Ilsa and Laszlo ask Rick to give the letters of transit for the other, not for themselves.
They're both far more selfless than he is.
Yes. And they both bring out the best in each other, and they both need each other, and they both obviously love each other, because love at its core is a selfless expression. So where Rick has been selfish and self-centered and heartbroken, appropriately so, he probably recognizes in them a love that he doesn't really have with Ilsa.
See, I look at it from a different perspective. I think that the way that Ilsa described her love for Victor was a very young and innocent love. She'd never met a man like him before, and she was so enamored with him. And then as she grew and matured and then lost Victor, because we also remember, too, that losing people changes who we are as people.
Right.
Even if it turns out that they're alive, who you are is different. You're
right.
Not the same person that you were before. And so I think that as she matured, her falling in love with Rick was as a different person. It was a more mature kind of love. It was one that came with baggage. And so where she had this innocent young love with Victor, she had this more mature broken love with Rick. But it was that innocent love that persisted.
Well, and I also think that something which we lost in our culture, which I wish we would recapture, is the sense of duty. So both Ilsa and Victor feel a duty not only in their marriage, but to the greater cause that Laszlo can inspire against the Germans and against the Axis powers. And even Rick recognizes that. That's why he's like, he won't be able to do his work if you're not with him. It's kind of like, yeah, we have this passionate love, right? She's most vulnerable when Rick comes into her life because she's alone and her husband is dead, or she thinks so. And he's been fighting against the Nazis, not as part of an army, but as like an underground movement. So they're both just very lonely people who come together at the right time. But that generation, that greatest generation, as they're called, had a greater sense of duty over personal want and personal need. It's why you had so many people sign up to join the army and to fight the Nazis and be willing to die to save and protect their loved ones. So it's refreshing in this movie to see these characters who go, yeah, I personally would rather be with you, but my duty and the greater need of the world is for me not to be with you and to be with this person. Or for Rick, the world is a better place if the love of my life is not with me, but with this other person. That's a really great sense of selflessness and duty that we don't really get a lot today.
It's interesting to me that Casablanca is remembered as a romantic drama because it's a very political film. An incredibly political film, not just in the way that it's filmed, but also in when it was released and all of that stuff. In the film, Rick is an interesting character, but he's also a representation of America. Because while America was in the war at this time, when the film takes place, it's before America joined the war. So as Rick is in this stage of limbo, so is America, because they were involved in World War I. They were kind of hurt by World War I. They don't really want to get involved again, which is kind of how Rick's character is approaching all of this. He'd been hurt in his fights before. He'd been hurt by Ilsa. He has values and morals. He just doesn't really want to get involved. But then there are times he can't help but get involved, whether actively or permissively, whether by helping that young couple or by shooting the Gestapo. When he's true to himself, he has to act in a way that's aligned with his values. But when I think about Rick's character growth, not only is it letting Ilsa go and sort of reclaiming that love story, which he said he'd lost, it's also about him exiting limbo and being willing to stand for something like he was before. Whereas Ilsa's character presents an entirely different question, which is interesting. Her character, I saw a couple of film critics describe her character as asking this question. How do you maintain a commitment when the world is literally falling apart? And every part of her life really points to that. She was committed to her husband, but then he was gone. The world was falling apart. And then she was committed to Rick, but then the world was falling apart and her husband was back. How do you make decisions and do what's right and maintain a commitment? What commitment is more important to keep? Is the commitment to marriage more important? Is the commitment to your heart more important? And these questions have significant ramifications depending upon how you answer them. And her character constantly asks that question throughout the film. It's an interesting juxtaposition for me because as I was watching this movie, another movie came to mind, which takes place in the 40s, but was made in 2005, I think, called The Notebook.
Right.
And it's such a different telling of a story because it's about two people who fell in love when they dated when they were in high school. They were 17. And then life brought them in different directions. They never really got over each other, but the girl gets engaged to someone else. The guy goes off and fights in war. Then they end up getting together, even though she's still engaged to this other guy. And there's a scene that she goes and confesses everything that she's done to her fiance. And he says, it's normal not to forget your first love, which I think is true. You know, your first love is a unique thing. You're never going to be able to replicate that exactly. But he says, but I want you for myself. And the movie ends with her going back to her first love. And so I think it's so interesting because that's the exact opposite of what happened in Casablanca. Whereas Ilsa had that young innocent love, you might say that her first real love, the first love that she really felt was with Rick. And so she couldn't let go of that. But her commitment was to Victor. Her commitment was greater to what they were fighting for. And then if you compare Rick and Laszlo, they're also interesting characters because they both have power, but in completely different ways. Rick likes his power. He likes being the one who's able to nod and say, yeah, you can do that. Or yeah, you can do that. He likes being in control, which is probably because in the past he's had no control. And so he really wants to hold on to that. But all of his power is based on authority, and authority can be taken away. Like, he happens to be the owner of this club. That's where his authority comes from. That's where all of his power comes from. Whereas Victor's power comes from his character and from his values. So wherever Victor goes, he has power because of who he is.
Yeah, Rick knows how to play the game in a corrupt world where Laszlo is trying to raise the world to be not corrupt.
It is interesting, too, though, with the film. There's two more things that I wanted to mention. One is that Rick actually does support commitment over his own self-interests. And you see that foreshadowed, what ultimately happens with Laszlo and Ilsa, with what happens with that young couple, because his casino takes a loss because he supports that young couple who want to be committed to one another over his own financial gain. So you kind of see that he really does believe in that. He's just a wounded puppy.
Right. That's a good point.
And then the other thing is I think the fact that Ilsa goes with Laszlo is one of the reasons the film is so powerful. You know, we always think of that last scene with Rick and Ilsa, here's to looking at you, kid, as this big romantic moment. And it is, but it subverted the expectations. She didn't stay with him and he didn't go with her. And yet people bring their fiancés and spouses and boyfriends and girlfriends and let's go watch this super romantic movie. And it doesn't end the way that you'd expect. And yet it stood the test of time. It's just really interesting to me.
Yeah, it's a selfless, noble love story as opposed to, oh, they get together at the end. You know what I mean? They sacrifice for each other for the greater good, which is a more powerful story.
And I like what Rick says at the end about how they'll always have Paris, but that they didn't until she came to Casablanca. And it makes me wonder if he felt like the whole thing was a lie. And then when he was confronted with reality, with the truth, then he was able to have peace. And I wonder if that's kind of like subtext of the story. Like there's an underlying truth that's worth fighting for, and it'll give you peace even if you don't get what you want.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the things that makes the story so great. One thing I've wanted to mention. So one of the funny things about the writers is that in the very opening of the movie, when they're introducing the world and the characters and so forth, the crime is committed. And you hear Renaud say to gather up the usual suspects because in basic petty crimes, it's usually the same people who are robbing and so forth. So what's funny is at the end of the story, the writers had written themselves into a corner because they knew Rick was going to kill Strasser, but they had no idea how to get him out of it. They were driving on their way to the studio and they were just thinking to themselves, and they both, because they're brothers, they both pop their heads up and says, the usual suspects.
And Renaud smirks when he says that line in the film. He's like, round up the usual suspects. It gives the audience exactly what they want in that moment.
Yeah. And it's such a perfect out, right? It's like, well, this is what they do. Whenever there's a crime that they don't know who did it, they just round up the usual suspects and hope one of them confesses.
And he stays a corrupt police official like he always was.
He does. So to wrap up, I think Casablanca has come to represent the aesthetics of a romantic longing. As one writer said, if Citizen Kane represents the pinnacle of artistic heroic courage, and Gone with the Wind epitomizes the colorful bluster of the American epic, then Casablanca is surely the film that defines cinematic cool. For me, Casablanca falls into that rare category of film that if I stumble across it on television, I will always stop what I'm doing and watch it. The black and white cinematography keeps it ageless, and the dialogue is exceptionally witty with a touch of modern cynicism. And Casablanca never gets old because it maintains its allure and entertainment value no matter how many times you watch it.
It really is one of those films you can watch time and time again and notice different things each time you watch it.
Yeah, and it's weird because you'll see it and you'll know those lines are coming, right? Mm-hmm. And for some reason, those lines don't get old. When I finally saw The Godfather, I had heard everything about it. I'd seen all the parodies of it, and I just had never happened to see it. So when I finally got around to see it, it was actually not enjoyable because I knew what was going to happen because I'd heard it all, right? And I'd seen it all. But for some reason, even though I know all the lines that are going to happen in this movie and they're clever and they're witty, it just never gets old. It's just, it's one of these weird things, like I said in the beginning, where you kind of want to be there. It's a place you want to be, even though you don't want to be in the circumstances those people are in. You want to hang out with these characters, basically.
What, you don't want to be in The Godfather?
It depends if I'm on which end of the gun I'm on, I think. But you know what I mean? Like, you want to be at Rick's. You want to be dressed cool. You want to have power. It's a place you want to be when this place is also so tragically difficult.
It really is a remarkable film, and it has earned its spot on many lists of the greatest films of all time, for sure.
Yeah. All right, so that's it for this episode of Story Junkie.
Thank you guys for joining us. We hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Please leave a comment below and let us know if you liked it.
And if you want us to analyze and look at a movie, a book, a TV show, just let us know, and we'll do it. Maybe.
Maybe. I'm not watching 8 seasons of Breaking Bad, so... I've heard it's one of the greatest shows of all time.
That is a commitment. Not doing it. That is definitely a commitment. So thank you all for joining us, and we will see you next time.